Tonight, we're going to bridge the gap between the paranormal and religion. Two special guests with us, and we'll be back with them in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Two special guests for you. Our first, Scott Smith, is an author and award-winning business journalist who has had more than 2,000 articles published, including interviews with leaders such as Bill Gates, Meg Whitman, Stan Lee, Richard Branson, Buzz Aldrin, Shark Tank's Mark Cuban, and Quincy Jones. The focus on the worldly has helped him keep his objectivity when writing about the supernatural for Fate magazine and other media. Scott, welcome back.
Ready for another wild ride.
Me too, my friend. Hold on and don't fall off. Sandra Wells with us, award-winning visionary artist and insatiable thirst for spiritual answers about the paranormal. He started from an early age studying and later spent 9 years working with a real practitioner of ceremonial magic. She has known a wide range of prominent seekers, including Timothy Leary, Aldous Huxley, Michael Crichton, and she has had two near-death experiences, which helped make her psychic and attracted many magical experiences. We'll talk about that. Hello, Sandra.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. How about you?
Great.
Good, good. Scotty, let's start with you. What's your take on all these UFO stories that have been popping all over the place?
Well, I didn't pay any attention to it until the mid-80s, and I thought, this is going to be like the JFK assassination. I'll read some books on it. Nobody's going to come to any conclusions, and it'll be kind of interesting. So I innocently started out reading about it as kind of a hobby. And in the 80s, I was working for three Democratic presidential campaigns, and I was going to Las Vegas for various reasons. And I didn't know Harry Reid at the time, but I did come to know him. And Mormons, and I was Mormon at the time, just like he is, Mormons believe there is intelligent life on other planets. They have, this is part of their theology. The goal is godhood and you get your own planet and all that kind of stuff. So it would not be unusual for Mormons to believe in UFOs and ETs. But the problem for me was that the more I studied it, I got into the abduction phenomenon. And I thought this had very serious religious implications. And by the time I got to the end of 1988, I was having some real issues about Mormon theology, and I went through the Landmark Forum, or what used to be called EST. And all this kind of stress triggered a mystical experience that made me realize that most religions were perpetuating an understanding of reality that didn't match up with things like alien abductions. Right. I really couldn't explain it. Now, when I met Harry Reid shortly thereafter to interview him for my newsletter for Mormon Democrats I was publishing, I knew he knew about Area 51 in Nevada, of course, but we didn't talk about the stuff at the time because, no, first of all, nobody knew who he was.
You would have been the first one to get him.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, I guess he's kept this under wraps. He and I certainly didn't talk about it, even though I was going through a spiritual crisis over this at the time. And so that's how I got started on it. And I did have one UFO sighting in the truly unidentified sense on a Halloween with a couple of police officers who said they saw nothing like this ever. And that was this weird, ever-changing bunch of lights about a few hundred feet up. It didn't seem to be a balloon, wasn't a plane. They checked with the local airports out in Ventura County. We couldn't figure out what it was, but then I started running into all kinds of people who told me some pretty convincing stories, but that's how I got interested in all this.
Fantastic. And Sandra, you had your own UFO experience, didn't you?
Yes, I did. It was in 1965, I think. I was on my way to a Gurdjieff meeting, and I was wearing my black and white kind of Sufi dancing outfit, and I was going up the hill, Laurel Canyon and Mulholland Drive, and there's a great big space on top of the hill. And there, as I'm driving up there, I see this, what I think is a circus balloon or some kind of advertisement. I'm looking for signs. I see nothing, just this thing that seemed to be very far and very close at the same time. I parked my car in a safe place and tried to get a better look at it. Still nothing happened. I was there maybe, I don't know how many, 15 minutes or so. And then finally, I thought I'd be late for my meeting, so I got back in my car. And I heard nothing ever. When I got to the meeting, I asked other people. Nobody had seen anything, never heard anything. I never saw anything about it on television. There's no reference to it on radio. And I just kind of like put it in the back of my mind. But I remember it being very vivid and very strange. And the colors were so unusual that I didn't forget it. I remember the date exactly. I remember how I felt about it. And they all kind of laughed at me at the meeting. They said, no, we saw nothing. And that was the end of it. That was the first and only time I've ever seen anything like that. And that was my only exposure. But it was quite dramatic.
What do you think you saw, Sandra?
I think it was some kind of a ship of something. It was kind of flat shape. It was kind of pancakey looking. And it had, but the lights that were blinking off and on made me think it could be an ad for a circus. It could be some kind of a, I was looking for some kind of a identification, some kind of a, like a trailer in the sky or some kind of writing. I saw it just by itself. It's very difficult to figure out why it didn't seem like I could measure the distance. It seemed like it was just there and kind of stood there. And it was a very big opening. It's like in between the mountains on Coldwater and Mulholland.
Right.
There's like a space there that is open, and there really is not mountains there. There's just nothing there. And I guess
it's like an open tunnel or something.
Well, it seemed to be a strange feeling because I couldn't find any connection with where it came from or what it looked like or any ties to anything. I knew I questioned people at the meeting. I said, did anyone see anything? No, no, no. All around the hill, no. Nobody saw a thing. They all looked at me. They started giggling. And I thought, well, I know I didn't imagine it. I remember parking the car and walking over. And there was nobody around me. There was no cars. It was like 5 or 6 in the evening. It wasn't that dark yet. It was kind of lightish. There was nobody. There was no traffic. I don't remember exactly why there wasn't much traffic. Laurel Canyon is quite a populated area.
Oh, it sure is.
That's
it's heavily congested.
Time I did see something. So it was quite something.
And Scott, 23 years ago, you were the editor of a Las Vegas magazine, which is called Las Vegas Magazine. And you did an interview with Dr. Dean Radin, a regular Coast to Coast guest, didn't you?
Yeah, he is one of the great finds of scientific minds that are open and are willing to really test out their assumptions. And I had already been writing for Fate magazine since 1990, and I heard about his work, and then he came out in 1997 with his first big book, The Conscious Universe, which was basically about the scientific evidence for ESP, and he got fired for it.
Yeah, that cost him his job.
Yeah. So my story for Las Vegas Magazine was kind of what happened. And so he was a very interesting candidate for taking a serious look at this because he was magna cum laude graduate in electrical engineering, which is about as hardcore as it gets. He got a master's, PhD, and he was a tech researcher at Bell, where he got interested in the black thumb phenomenon, where certain people would get near machines and they would break down. And so he started studying it, and that brought him to the attention of the Stanford Research Institute.
Yes.
And they were famous for testing psychics like Uri Geller and so on.
And I think he's still a part of that, isn't he?
Yeah, and he went there for a year sabbatical, and what shocked him was, once he was kind of sworn in to secrecy, is he found out that the atheist Russians and Chinese, the communists, were very big on ESP and ways to use psychic powers because it was, to them, very natural, not supernatural. So after he left there, he went to Princeton, did a bunch of meta studies. One of them, I recall, showed the odds for chance being a trillion to one. And that led him, his reputation led him to Robert Bigelow underwriting his research at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. And that was 1993. He did some very good experiments that even the skeptics were impressed by. So he compiled them together and other information.
And Bigelow picked up that whole tab, didn't he?
Yeah, right. And so you would have thought that his situation was secure because Bigelow is famous for underwriting controversial projects. But what happened was when the book came out, there was a backlash from the faculty. They felt he had embarrassed them, you know, coming out in favor of this weird paranormal stuff. And when he came back and was told he was fired, the dean kept giving him different contradictory reasons for it. And he realized it was just political pressure. So, you know, he went on to better things. But meantime, most of the mainstream science magazines refused to review it. They would, when it was reviewed in the British magazine Nature, they would not publish a letter from him in response pointing out the mistakes in this negative review. And finally, the editor left after 8 months and they were willing to publish it. But, you know, the when I started writing the article and then later when I was doing a chapter on this in God Reconsidered, kind of updating it, I called the two groups, the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry and the Skeptic Society, and they both referred me to Ray Hyman, who's their point man on things like ESP. Now, he didn't call me back. I wanted a quote for my article, for my book, and Radin explained to me that he sat down after he listened to a lecture by Ray Hyman about what was wrong with Radin's ideas and ESP and so forth, and he had dinner with him, and he went point by point why he was scientifically wrong. And so that's why I didn't get a call back, because Hyman knew that I would just go back to Radin and refute everything he said. And, you know, his more recent book, Radin's recent book, Real Magic, has more examples of this close-mindedness, and this is across academia. It's not just in the paranormal. It's this this phenomenon that Thomas Kuhn, who wrote the classic Structure of Scientific Revolution, said is the gatekeepers are always two generations behind the pioneering work because they've been teaching this stuff for 20 years, and then you got to wait for a couple of generations to die off before they allow you in the academic journals and to be able to, you know, talk about this at conferences and stuff. So, you know, he was basically a victim of that, and the situation has not improved. You know, there's still, you go on Wikipedia and you read a lot of nonsense because they're very good at manipulating that. So that was my and I've stayed in touch with him since then.
Well, he's done some great work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Everybody should read this new book, Real Magic, because he really takes it a step further and, you know, talks about, you know, hundreds of people witnessing levitation and things like that. So he's easy to read, too, and he goes into why the skeptics are the way they are.
You wrote the book God Reconsidered back in what, 2019?
It was 2014 when it first came out. But
and then
I
you updated
really,
it?
A crummy publisher who was crooked, and so it took him a year to get the thing into paperback. It came out in Kindle, but, you know, that's a whole thing of itself. But I did open with the chapter on Radin and ESP because I wanted a Trojan horse to say, let's forget God for the moment. How about the paranormal? And then I went on to the next chapter was UFOs, and the third chapter is near-death experiences. And I tried to show how the skeptics always lie about where the evidence is because they can't handle it. And they all act like they're in the Catholic Church when the bishop says, don't read this list of banned books because, you know, they're not right. And so whenever I would talk to these skeptics and try to get them to read Radin's book, they would say, well, there's a Berkeley professor who told me, you know, it's full of nonsense. And I said, well, why don't you just read the book and decide for yourself? No, I respect this guy. You know, it's a cult.
Absolutely. And Sandra, you introduced Scotty to two famous psychics. One's a dear friend of ours, Uri Geller. The other was Peter Hurkos, who was dead And didn't I remember seeing Peter Hurkos on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson?
Yeah, yes, he was on The Tonight Show. And Peter was a dear friend of mine for 20 years. I met him in the mid-60s, and he was a friend for a long, long, long time. And finally, I got to meet Andre Baharish after 20 years, and I met Andre, I think, in 1987.
Friend of Uri Geller's, too, isn't he?
Yeah. He's the one that brought Uri Geller to this country, and he's
right.
He met him in 71. And he was the one that was the biggest fan of Uri Geller and Peter, of course, but Uri Geller in particular because he wrote the book Uri. And the book itself was a shocker and caused quite a bit of scandal because it really put Uri in a situation. He did say it was all true, and then he kind of hedged a little bit because it was kind of a scandal that he put him up there. He said he was like the communication ambassador to the world through the UFOs. And Andrea had a great background, 55-plus patents, an MD, very renowned, very, very much of a very big investigator, and very prominent, and I think he was sort of embarrassed for him. And now, of course, Uri is very wealthy, living in London with his family, and is able to sue people that defame him. I think he's won a case with James Ramsey, whatever his name is, recently or some years ago. But he fought back, and he's doing extremely well. But when I went to see Andre Baharish, he invited me to his home in North Carolina, and I went there for a whole week. I was really interested in what he had going on. And while I was there, he gave me some of his books, not every one, but some of them. And he also gave me Nikola Tesla's manuscript, the one that he was working on for 30 years, that has a lot of UFO reference in it, and it's a magnifying transmitter, unpublished, 30-year study. For some reason, he could not get it published, too much hassle, and he gave me one of his unpublished limited editions, and, you know, it's quite fabulous, of course, but it was the most interesting of times, and then Andrea absolutely was convinced that Uri was the man of the world. I think he might have hypnotized him once, that I could read in the book. And there was no index in the back. I had to read the whole book to see what they were talking about. But Andrea did bring Peter here, and Peter was the most fantastic.
And Peter died tragically. He fell or something, didn't he?
What?
He fell and went into a coma or something, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Peter fell off a ladder. When he was a young boy, he was a house painter, fell off a ladder, and when he got revived, he touched anything and anybody, and their whole background, present and future, was apparent to him. And he had very, very broken English, you know, man without kind of a speech problem, but he was so fantastic and brought to the attention of everybody that Andrea heard about him, tested him, brought him to this country. And when I met him, as I said, he had a client list that was unbelievable.
Yep. Stay with us, Sandra and Scotty. We'll be back with both of you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're going to take your calls next hour with Scott Smith and Sandra Wells as we talk about bridging the paranormal and spirituality. And welcome back to Coast, back with Scott Smith and Sandra Wells. The website, godreconsidered.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Scott, after you and Sandra tested Geller's powers for the Psychic World magazine, what did you think of him?
Well, I read James Randi's skeptical book first, and I went in very thinking that maybe he was a phony and a trickster. And so I did all the things James Randi said to do to protect him from telling what you were drawing and so forth. And he guessed it anyway. And then Sandra and I went to a public demonstration of his key bending in this case. And Randi said, he touches the keys or the spoons or whatever with a little chemical, and that's why they seem to melt.
You're
well,
right.
We brought two keys we didn't need anymore. We held them up. We were about 50 feet away. and he bent him.
Huh.
So, you know, the problem with the skeptics is they just are intellectually dishonest with themselves and with their cult followers. And if you try to persuade them, they're not going to listen to reason. There's really not much you can do about it. So he was the real thing. And we had a rapport. He had read my book on the soul of your pet, and he's a big animal lover. And so we really developed a good rapport, and I worked with him on a couple of things over the next year.
Yeah, he's pretty good. We had him on the show many times, but one time he was on, Scott and Sandra, he wanted everybody who was listening to bring their dead watches and clocks close to the radio. And he was going to say, run, 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 or work, 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 whatever he said. And people would email me saying, my watch that hasn't worked in 2 years is clicking now. It's ticking along, or my clock is working. It was amazing. Well, what even is stranger is that program, we re-aired it on a Saturday for stations that like to run more coast-to-coast programs. And this was like months away, months away. And all of a sudden, I'm looking at my emails going, why are all these people emailing me about Uri Geller and his watches and clocks? And it dawned on me that we were running the rerun of the program where he said, take your watches and clocks, put them by the radio, and, you know, run, run, run.
Wow.
And it worked.
Yeah. Now, he's pretty amazing. And, you know, as Sandra mentioned, he'd become quite rich by the time we met him, and he was a little embarrassed by Andrea Paharich's book about their escapades with UFOs and stuff. So we asked him, did this stuff really happen? And he said, yes. And I found that really amazing because he could have, their part of it was under hypnosis. And the skeptics have jumped on that and said, oh, he's said that you know, the whole thing was phony and so forth. But no, we pointedly said, is the book that Andrea wrote accurate? Is it factual? And he did say, you know, I can't vouch for, you know, being, you know, the representative of the extraterrestrials on Earth and stuff. That was under hypnosis. But they did have UFO encounters. He confirmed it. And I thought that took a lot of guts because this was a time when he had reemerged after kind of disappearing for a while and concentrating on working for companies to discover gold and things like that. So he had his own UFO encounters and was pretty candid about it. And that led to a collaboration where he paid for me to do the research to pull together a book that we were both frustrated by the skeptics because the books tended to be on a single case or they were all over the place with the good cases and the bad cases. There really wasn't a book out you could hand to a skeptic, and it would make them realize that there was really something that needed to be looked at more closely. So we pulled it together, but it was just not in time. The publishers had been flooded for the 50th anniversary of Roswell. They didn't understand the difference with our book. So this whole thing process took over about 6 months to work on, but I ended up publishing the chapters in UFO magazine, so it ended up being used anyway.
Wasn't Geller zapped by a UFO, and that's how he got some of these mystical powers?
Well, I don't know if he was zapped. It seems like he was, at 3 years old, he went into this garden as a child in Palestine, and he had this unbelievable experience. And that was the time when he said something appeared to him, his life changed, and he kind of tried to hide his gift from his classmates and his mother. He kind of didn't know what to do with it for a long, long time. But he had some kind of encounter. Something happened then that set the place for him. And he became, first, everybody just was amazed at what he could do, became a performer so he could make money at it, became a model. You know, he was very ambitious, very anti-aging. He did exercise.
He still looks great for 74 years old.
Yeah, well, now, this is when I saw him last, let's say it was some years ago. I think this was in 97. He was like 50-something, and he was 50 miles a day, supposedly, on his bike and on a big health program. Think he was a vegetarian, vegan. Think he was really health and anti-aging conscious. And I think that he has grown tremendously. I hadn't heard much other than he's been very successful, making a lot of money. And that's the best revenge of all. He sues anybody that defames him and upsets him. And he's very, very confident. And
I think he's got a car with bent spoons all over the place.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's just, I mean, I've just reread the whole Uri book to see because there was no index. And boy, I'll tell you, this man was unbelievable, is unbelievable. So I don't know what's going to be happening in the future and how this UFO thing is affecting him right now. I'm sure we'll find out. But there's certainly been a lot of publicity about it.
He emailed me a couple weeks ago when they were getting bombed out in Israel.
And what?
But when those rockets were going back and forth. But he's okay.
Okay.
He's okay.
Well, that's great. I don't know where he's living now and what he's doing, but that was the last time we had seen him. I know Scott was amazed when he did all that work. Because he's not really easily impressed.
Yeah, he's in Jaffa.
Yeah, but he was the real deal. He's the real deal, and I thought that they gave him a hard time with the reports and whatever, and he was really kind of embarrassed somewhat about. He said to me at the time that he kind of felt a little sorry that Andrea put himself on the line like that. You know, he didn't really know what to really. It was just so much. Pretty fantastic stuff, I must say.
You two have interviewed some great UFO witnesses. How about you, Scott? What's the most prominent one?
Yeah, while we were working for Fate, and I did a magazine for an article for Los Angeles Magazine, and we went around. Interviewing people in L.A. It was about the UFO phenomenon in L.A., which really started in 1942, well before the famous episode that got flying saucers the name of Mount Rainier. In 1942, there was a really serious UFO incident. Everybody thought it was the Japanese with something that hovered over L.A., and they shot thousands of rounds at it and couldn't dent it, and it just stood there. And so we went around and interviewed quite a number of people that had some pretty interesting stories to say about their own experiences. L.A., not surprisingly, has been a hotbed for the UFO phenomenon, and a lot of the researchers have lived here. UFO Magazine was published here first by Vicki and Don Ecker and then by Nancy and Bill Burns. And Don was one of the most interesting guys because he had a really hardcore background as a special ops guy in Vietnam in the 70s. He had an above top secret crypto access clearance, and he knew somebody from the NSA, and then when he was severely injured or lost his leg while he was a narcotics officer up in Idaho, and that's where he started hearing from all the ranchers about UFOs or lights coming in and cattle mutilations and all those kind of things. And after he talked to the friend of the family about the NSA, this really got him interested in trying to take an objective approach to it. So they became a fairly credible publication in the field. And so we interviewed them, and we interviewed Ann Druffel, who's a well-regarded author. And one of the people that we met with was Michael Bershad, who is known as Steve Kilburn in Bud Hopkins' Missing Time. And eventually he came out with his own name. That was to protect his identity. And he talked about his abduction, and he underwent polygraphs, hypnosis. And one surgeon told us that the details that he talked about when he was supposedly operated on in the UFO, he said the surgeon told him, there's only a dozen people in the world that understand the significance of what you said. So he was just one of many people that we talked with. Also, C.D. B. Bryan, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, wrote Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, and I interviewed him, and he had the same reaction I did to the abduction thing. He said he got out of it because it was the whole abduction thing was starting to seem like Alice in Wonderland and driving him crazy. And so it was quite the adventure. But anyway, the editors got fired before it was published for reasons having nothing to do with this article. New editor came from W, a fashion magazine. He said, it's really not my thing. So he paid me, and I ended up taking it to UFO Magazine. So that ended up getting published there. So that was kind of a wild ride, but it was a great access, Los Angeles Magazine, to be able to talk to people who might not otherwise want to talk. Sandra, do you recall anything from that research?
Well, I remember that we went to the office of Dr. Robert Lear in Thousand Oaks, and he had shown us small little objects he took from the bodies
of people, implants,
victims. Yeah. And he said that... And that we had a team of doctors that worked on these individuals. And we did see he's dead serious, and we believed him. And he showed us little chips or something. I guess they're like a tracking device that were put in the bodies. And we happened to meet two abductees that were very impressive. One was a man, dead serious, scared to death, and a woman. Also, you can tell by their face, they were frightened beyond belief. The only two I really met, and I really believed them, I really thought they went through something very traumatic. But this Dr. Roger Lear,
Roger, yeah,
was the doctor that supposedly removed all these little tracking devices.
Yeah, what he said was these were magnetic implants surrounded by nerve tissue. They didn't have any inflammatory cells, which was significant. And he put me on the phone with one of his colleagues and said he was working with about a dozen people. I haven't followed up with him to see where that stood, but it seemed to mystify.
Well, Roger has passed on. Roger's not with us anymore.
Ah. Well, I used to live out in Thousand Oaks, and he had an office there. So back then we did meet with him. But, I haven't heard, I haven't really been following the abduction field until recently, so I don't know how the whole implant effort went.
But you believe that this latest episode of the UFOs might be non-terrestrial?
Yes. I've certainly talked to enough credible witnesses to believe there is something going on, and I believed it was extraterrestrial up until...
You changed your mind.
Some years ago. There are problems with that scenario, however. It seems logical. But the first problem is that, people will say, well, there's 88 billion planets that might harbor intelligent life. But I read David Waltham's Lucky Planet, and he said, the problem with that is that each of these phases of evolution takes millions of years, and if you don't get through each one in lockstep, then nothing happens. And so, the whole process of evolution was 4.5 billion years and 600 million from multicellular creatures, and it doesn't seem like there is any intelligent design. If you look at the 600 million years, there are all kinds of screw-ups, starting with the fact that 99% of species are extinct. You look at human beings, the woman's pelvis is badly designed, the male urinary and prostate cross over and cause problems. The eyeball is basically backwards, which is why we have bad vision when we get older. And if the aliens were really in charge and they were an advanced civilization, would they have sat around for 168 million years waiting for the dinosaurs to develop and then say, well, this isn't working out, let's bring in some asteroids? It doesn't seem to make any sense. And what surprised me was the relatively recent research on cellular intelligence in a number of books. And this is related to evolution because it turns out that you can make a very credible case that without God, without aliens, evolution would have proceeded as it did with all the imperfections and screw-ups and some intelligence here or there. If you go to GodReconsidered.com and just click on the Facebook logo, I have all the evolution information there in a blog called The Big Issues Religions Ignore. The other thing that got me thinking about this was Jacques Vallée, the guy who was
great researcher. Hold on, Scott. We'll come back and talk about Jacques and get you, Sandra, and also an hour of phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. We will be right back.